Hello, my name is Xenia Makoski, and I am a student co-supervisor and a student project manager here at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. Here with me today is Sister Rosemary Nirambe, who is giving a talk this evening, January 31st, at the Clark Forum, entitled Gender-Based Violence in Women's Education. For over 30 years, Sister Rosemary has served victims of violent civil wars that have decimated northern Uganda and South Sudan. In 2014, Sister Rosemary was named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in the World. Additionally, she has received a CNN Hero Award, United Nations Impact Award, and she's been honored by the Women of the World Summit conferences, including in New York City, San Francisco, Austin, Switzerland, and London. She's also the subject of the book and documentary, Sowing Hope. So, Sister Rosemary, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for welcoming me here.
I'm sure you've spoken about this before, but for those who might not be aware, would you be able to give a little bit of a background of the conflict in northern Uganda and a summary of the work you've been doing over the past 20 years with women and children?
Yeah, it is true. I've spoken about this very many times, but it's always like new, not only to those who have not listened, but also to me, because there are certain things which affect humanity, and for me that always will remain new. The conflict in northern Uganda started way back in 1986. That was started by one woman called Alice Lakwena. She started a conflict which she thought would be one way of overthrowing an existing government, but she got ousted by the government soldiers, and later on her own cousin took over. The cousin was called Joseph Kony, who is the current leader of the Lord's Resistance Army. But much as this war and conflict started with an intention, I say in quotes, maybe they thought it was a good intention, that is saving people, saving their own people, and by overthrowing the existing government, it turned out to be so brutal because their main target, their main focus remained on women and children. These were people who were abducted by these rebels, taken to captivity, and children were trained to become child soldiers. Then it became even worse, especially for young girls who were abducted, because the rebels really prized them to become sex slaves and also trained soldiers. This was something which devastated the whole community, and those children were trained to kill. They were forced to kill. Sometimes they were brought back to the community where they were abducted and forced to commit atrocities against their own people, against their siblings, even sometimes their parents. And this actually made the whole movement of the Lord's Resistance Army very, very infamous, because they were not doing any good. They were causing more damage. They were causing a lot of atrocities. And eventually, the government planned to relocate a lot of people to displaced people's camps, thinking that was a way of protecting people, but that was the most dehumanized condition as well in camps. Children were growing in those camps, and eventually the rebels started coming to attack some of those camps. And of course, they would attack the soldiers and move to people and abduct people also from the displaced people's camps. So the whole problem of the Lord's Resistance Army went on and on for quite a long time, until 2006, when we could hear that there was a little bit of peace, the rebels were chased away, but people remain living in fear until today.
How does your role fit into all of this? How did you come to be at St. Monica's?
I was sent to St. Monica by my superiors, and I really took it as part of my vow of obedience to go there, because when the war started, I was in Gulu but not in St. Monica. And of course, I knew exactly the complexity of the war. I knew how it was moving. And when I managed to escape with some of our sisters who were three, we escaped and went to a better place, to a safer place in our convent. I took time to reflect, because we were deeply traumatized. And later on, I decided to go back to do my studies, and I went to college. I finished all my studies. After completing, I came back and told the superiors, I'm now ready like for deployment. And they decided to send me back to Gulu. So I took it that it was for me God's arrangement that I should go there, even if the situation was bad. And at that time, the situation was more complex. But I told the superiors, don't apologize, I'll go, even if it means I have to build life on top of water. And that's how I went to St. Monica, without knowing St. Monica itself had girls who had escaped from captivity. There were not many girls who had about 30 girls only, because the situation could not allow anybody to come to school anymore. But what I found was very, very painful and difficult was there were so many children running every day from their villages, coming to hide in different places. And St. Monica was one of the places they were hiding in. And these children were known as night commuters by international communities. So every day we would see children with us, more than 300 to 500. And of course, the task was for us really to make sure these children were safe. We were hiding them. It was very painful to see children lying on the floor, and sometimes without blankets, with no food and everything. So that was the most difficult situation I found there.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit too about how you became a nun. What did you know that you always wanted to become a nun as a child, and what was your religious background like growing up?
No, I didn't know growing up that I was going to become a nun. My religious background is I got it from my parents. They are Catholics. And I grew us all up as Catholics. And that's really all what I know. But then again, I knew my parents were very close to church. They were God-fearing people. And that is the situation I grew up in. But the idea of becoming a nun was not on my bucket list. I never thought of it. But eventually, I started growing up and taking care of my nieces, the sisters of my children. I loved them. We grew up together quite closely. And for me, it was even very difficult to think and imagine that I would leave home, leave my parents, leave my brothers and sisters, because I felt so loved. I'm the seventh of eight children in the family, and I am the last of the girls. So I was kind of really, really loved by everybody. And so just thinking of going to the convent was like a sudden light, a sudden call to say, okay, you've heard about what is happening. And I heard about some nuns who came from South Sudan as refugees. They came to Uganda. They settled in a place. And when I heard these nuns were more involved in taking care of orphan children and vulnerable people, old people, I kind of felt like I could be like them. And I straight away thought I would join this group. And for me, my whole idea was the attraction of caring for children. Because I was already caring for my nieces and nephews, I felt like God was calling me from what I've been doing to continue doing it in a different way. But as a young girl at 15 or 14, it's very difficult to know exactly what call exactly you're going to. And I went, of course, I had so many things which I started questioning. First, I was in a mixed school with boys and girls. Then I went to the convent. I found that place had only women, girls. I said, okay, this is difficult for me, because I lived with my brothers and sisters. I went to school and with boys and girls. And here I found a different environment. I'd never seen so many nuns living together. I said, oh my God. Now I have to be with these people. So the next thing, which was quite difficult for me to handle, was the sleep pattern, because these people were waking up every day, 5:30 they would ring the bell and everybody would wake up, and that was really disturbing for me. I questioned and say, if I want to be with these people, how long am I going to do this? Waking up early, I love to sleep, and now I'm not having my enough sleep. That was one of my biggest challenges. But again, eventually I found I grew up in all this. I like it. I started accepting it more and more. I remained focused. That's like I grew up in it. And that's how my background was.
You know, one of the things that struck me as I read Sowing Hope was when you arrived at St. Monica's, you had no previous experience in teaching or counseling. How did you feel walking into that situation? Did you encounter any fear or insecurity, and how did you kind of combat that and grow into your new role?
Well, I got not really fear, but kind of doubt. What can I do here? Can I be effective in any way? But then I decided to read the signs of time, and this time I can see the situation of children and women. Why can I not be closer to them? Why can I not do something to change their lives? First, when I found so many of these children who are hiding and sleeping there, I decided to play a role of a leader. I decided to play a role of bringing them every evening together, putting them in groups, letting them tell stories. And when we started giving them some little food, I had to organize the bigger ones to cook and then distribute to their friends. So from time to time, with some sisters who would come and give talks to these children. That was the way of making them feel comfortable, because it was not the best place to be in, or a scary situation. But then all the situation in St. Monica, I found they were not favoring me, except I had to think about what I can do to change the whole situation. When I look at the students, at the women who were there, I decided to say, okay, I am not a teacher, I'm not a seamstress, this is a tailoring school. And there was no way I could have been there, because I was not totally qualified to be there. But at the same time, since I am put here, I'm going to do everything I can in order to make a difference in this place. So I decided to make use of my prior knowledge, of my knowledge I got from my parents. I said, when I was growing up, I was taking care of the children. So here I got the children in the night commuters I had to take care of. When I was growing up, my parents taught me how to clean the house. My parents taught me how to cook. Why don't I teach this to these girls? Since they grew up in captivity, and many of them did not know this. So I made this become for me like a practical subject I can teach. And I had to teach by doing. I had to be with these girls, and my presence was for me very vital. Being there was a way of helping them understand that they are fully accepted. And really, that's all what I did without any background. And of course, when I introduced certain things like a cookery, I had to make it practical, but at the same time I had to seek the help of professionals who can come and teach these girls eventually. And that led me to start a catering school, which is going on up to now, hotel management. And it all started from having no experience, but confronting a situation with courage. Say, I can do it, I can start it, I don't have to be alone, I need someone's help, I will look for people who can help me.
So, since 2002, you've enrolled, I think the number is more than 3,000.
Yeah, it's possible.
Yeah, I mean, you can correct me, a lot of women, thousands of women in St. Monica.
Yeah.
And you've helped them regain dignity, independence, and you talk a lot about hope through tailoring, catering, and practical skills. So, I was wondering if you could share any stories or women that particularly stick out to you for being maybe inspirational or even challenging that you've worked with over the past several years.
Yeah, I worked with a lot of women who are quite inspirational to me, who also had challenging situations. The most challenging things I heard about some of these women is that, first, I didn't know that I had girls who were in captivity. And when I came to know, I had to sit down, listen to them, and play the role of a counselor in order to let them understand that I'm ready to listen to them. And that made me to enter into their situation to hear so many things which they went through. One challenging situation was one girl who I could observe every day was not able to sit with others. She was not able to interact with other people very well. She was kind of timid, but more than timid, she was scared of people looking her in the eyes. And so one time, they invited her to come and sit with me just to chat and relax. She was not able to look at me. She turned herself in another direction. And I called her by name and said, why don't you look at me? Am I so ugly that you can't look at me? And she laughed exactly like that. And she said, no, your sister, you're not ugly. Then look at me. Let's talk freely. So she started just talking with me, and I asked her why She was always isolated. Why? She was always feeling timid and kind of shy to look at people and didn't want people to look at her. And she told me, "Sister, I can't sit in a class. For me, when I sit in a class, my eyes are always paining." But yes, there was nothing like her eyes paining. Everything seemed to be fine. And I told her, I said, "If your eyes are paining, maybe we'll take you to see a doctor, but I think you look fine for me." And she said, "No, my eyes pain because when I was in captivity with the rebels, I grew to the rank of being a commanding officer, and I was always taken to the front line. So the smoke of guns from gunshots always affecting me and pains my eyes. That is where my eyes opened. And I started thinking, oh, I didn't know this girl was a commanding officer." And so I had to change my approach to her, of loving her a little more, of not fearing her, of drawing her closer and closer to me. So from where she was fearing people to look at her, I decided to invite her every time I was going out to town or to the market to come with me. In a way, I was playing a role of rehabilitating her by exposing her to the public, to let her understand that no one is actually looking at her, no one was judging her, no one was pinpointing at her. So I would move with this girl. When I go to the market, I would tell her, "Go and buy things that side, here is the money," and I would go another side, "Let's meet at this time." So it was a tactic I played to let her understand people were not judging her. For me, that girl was a great inspiration in many things, because I realized again that perhaps what we are offering, where I found they were teaching these girls academic tailoring, things were not the right thing we were offering. The subjects we were giving them was not right. And she told me she cannot manage the class like that. And I asked her, "Say, what about if I introduce practical skills in dressmaking and cutting? Do you think you can try that?" She told me, "Yes, I can try." And actually, that year, I introduced the practical skills in dressmaking and cutting, where you don't go through the academics, you don't go through the subject of mathematics and so forth. Because I realized the subject being offered was above the standard of education of these girls, because most of them had dropped out of school because they were abducted or for other reasons, or growing in internal displaced people's camps. And so Janet inspired me to introduce practical skills in that class. And when I introduced it, many girls went and joined her. Later on, I realized at the end of the year, this girl, Janet, was the best in that class after exams. She really passed with a very high marks. And I decided to convince her to continue. I sent her even for designing in Kampala, in the city, with one of the models who you would not believe. I don't know how she trained her, but they were there. I didn't follow anymore. But then that gave me a lot of inspiration that many girls didn't need the higher academic subjects of tailoring because of their reasons for dropping out of school. So that remained. If you go to St. Monica now, you will find we have two classes. One is written academic tailoring, and another one is practical tailoring. And we give the women who come a choice. You make a choice where you want to be according to your ability. That means we accept the women, the girls, to come as they are. And it's up to you to find where you can fit. But for us, the most important thing is to be able to give you that hope that your life can be rebuilt, that you can do something in future. In a way, it's something of trusting them and validating their prior knowledge.
What are some of the current projects that you're working on? Would you be able to share what daily life looks like, for example, at St. Monica's, and what you're doing at the Sewing Hope Children's Village?
Oh, well, there are many different projects I'm working on, and of course, I don't work alone. I work with the many helpers. I work with other sisters who take care. Like, for instance, now I've started a new project. I call it Learn and Earn. That means I'm teaching practical skills, but mostly it is in adult literacy, teaching women how to read and write. Because I found out there are a lot of women out there too who cannot read and write. And so I started this some years back, but it was not exactly attractive. They would come and fall out. So last year, I reworked the whole idea to the point that I wanted it to be more attractive. I reduced it to be for only 3 months instead of 1 year. And the 3 months that you come to learn how to read and write, and you choose whether you want to learn how to sew, whether you want to learn how to make purses, whether you want to learn agriculture, you will take it. And when you finish the agriculture or learning this, your reward as your part of your certificate will be giving you some of the resources, some of the startup capital to let you continue. And I found this was quite attractive to the women because I, first of all, with some of my friends from Oklahoma University and some sisters, we made assessment, like interviewing 20 women, because I planned to start it with 20 people. And the assessment was very, very helpful because you ask these women their level of education, what they own, do they have land, so that helped me to really plan the program according to the assessment. And this has already started and is going on in both places, in Gulu and in Atiak. 10 women in Gulu, 10 women in Atiak. In Atiak, it is a little different because we are running it with women who we had already employed to take care of the orphan children in Sewing Hope Children's Village. We have 10 houses, which takes 8 children in each of the houses and one mother. And so what came to me is that whatever we are paying this woman is not adequate. And apart from that, they are not really educated. They don't know how to read and write. So I introduced this to them in order for them to get some extra money to top on what we are giving them. But apart from that, is a way of equipping them to be able to fit in the society again. And so that program has just started, and I hope it can continue for more women in future.
It's amazing. In times of conflict, women and girls are more vulnerable to higher levels of gender-based violence, mm-hmm. as you've seen, especially sexual violence.
Yeah.
And it spikes even in post-conflict societies. What are some initiatives and changes that communities can make to transform societal structures and expand women's rights before a conflict arises?
Yeah, even before really we talk about that, one thing which I noticed is that during conflicts, a lot of women, also boys, are affected. But of course, the women have got the dual roles that they have to be like trained as child soldiers together with the boys. And then eventually they become sex slaves and then become mothers. It's like they're playing three roles. But then, after conflict, people do not think about the roles these women played. When the women are back in the community, they are treated the same with the boys, mm-hmm. without thinking that the gender-based violence was greater on women in many ways. And that has always been my problem. And so for that reason, I really totally believe women need to be empowered even before conflict and after conflict. And for me, the best way I look at that women should be empowered on is giving them education. The education which can give them a voice. It's not just education where you say, we have to train this woman just to go to college and write. That can also happen. But the education which can make them be important by themselves, where they can take their own destiny in their hands, where they can have a voice, be in any community, and they can be leaders also in those communities. They can say, this is not right for me, and this is right for me.
What are some of the barriers that you've faced in trying to rehabilitate women, either socially or culturally or politically, and how have you tried to combat them?
Well, the most barrier we face, and I should talk about in northern Uganda for instance, is the cultural barrier. In a way, northern Uganda is more of a patrilinear society, and of course there you find men are always preferred to girls in many, many things, even education, even at home. And in a way, women are really looked at as kind of low entity. Even in some of the society, in some of the cultures or some tribes in northern Uganda, You find this, what they, the question they put is, are women really humans? I mean, it's a difficult question to ask, but at the same time, this is the culture that look at women as a source of wealth, because being a source of wealth, they have to be married off, and when they are married off, dowries are paid to their parents, and of course, they receive this dowry as a kind of source of wealth for them. So that would easily tell you that they could think and say women are important, but they say still women are not important. But at the same time, I think this varies from families to families. Like if I talk about my own family, girls were very important in my family. We were 8, 4 boys and 4 girls. At the same time, the girls were much ahead of the boys in everything. And I always laugh because my name Nyirumbe has a different meaning. It means girls are not visible. And I wondered why my parents gave, when I asked who gave my name, they said, it's your dad who gave the name. Oh, my dad. In a society where they feel girls are less than boys, my dad realized that his daughters were important because in his own family, there were 9 boys and they didn't have a sister. So he loved his daughters. And so, even education-wise, my parents sent all of us to school, and it was my mother who stood firm that my children must all be educated. And of course, all the girls are more educated than the boys, unfortunately. So in a way, I think this depends a lot on different families as well.
I want to transition a little bit and talk about your role of service and what that's looked like for you. So Joseph Kony, who the leader of the Lord's Resistance Army, he claimed that he was a prophet, as he said, and he was sent by God to liberate human from disease and suffering and establish a new government based on the Ten Commandments. But he committed mass acts of atrocities against civilians. How do you regain the trust of people who have had traumatic experiences with religion in the past? And how do you encourage those who have experienced maybe religious trauma to find hope?
Well, it all depends on what different people went through. And of course, the idea that Joseph Kony is a prophet is the, okay, to me it's a false idea, but it is an idea more of fear in different people. Because even recently, speaking to some of the women, even his own child, when I talked to him, he said, my father is very smart and he has got that prophetic vision. When he speaks, something will happen. Well, but I came to conclude, that's my own thought, that the women who were abducted and were married off by Joseph Kony and came to his wives totally believe he is somebody like that. Because of the fear. Even if they are now freed, they are out, they still feel if we speak about him, something will happen to us. You know? In a way, it is something that a person who has been in slavery for long or has suffered so long, has been mistreated, start trusting the person who is mistreating. That is what I saw in these women. But to really say, this is a religious belief, a religious word, I don't think they believe is still religious. And many people too know that this is not religious. Then apart from that, like I am totally committed to supporting these people regardless of their religion. The sisters who live with me are totally committed to supporting these people regardless of what they believe in. I think that is enough to convince them that these women are actually religious women, but they're valuing us for what we are. Because our whole idea is for you to get hope, and if you ask me, say, do you preach religion to these women? I would always answer everybody, I do not preach religion to this, but my presence is enough to preach. My presence is enough to explain that I am there because of what I believe in. Because when you come from a very difficult situation, it's not very easy to find people who can, at no cost, accept you as you are. Knowing your background, knowing you are potential killers, still you accept it.
So many women have confided in you stories that are painful and traumatic. So how do you participate in their pain without feeling overwhelmed yourself?
I do feel overwhelmed sometimes, And of course, what makes me not really feel completely off is that I live in a community, a religious community of faith. And then I have my prayer all the time. We pray with the sisters. And of course, sometimes we pray with these girls. And I find that is quite refreshing for me. Getting away from time to time, have retreats, and then meeting different people I can share with. Like coming here to the United States, I'm able to tell the stories of these women. I'm able to speak on their behalf when they're not able to speak. Sometimes, really, what they trust me, I'm able to share with people who can take part in moving forward to support them. And I think this is the only thing which makes me always feel refreshed.
We talked about this yesterday, but I wonder if you could share it with people who might be listening. We see so many conflicts happening in the world. We talked about Ukraine, we talked about what's happening in Gaza and the Congo, that sometimes people can feel overwhelmed and feel like they can't make an impact because the problem is too large. What would you say to that?
I think that is really a negative way of looking at things, because it gives me a picture that sometimes we human beings want to approach things from a bigger level, from the macro level, and say, I cannot do this because it is too big. And yet, it's very important for us all to approach any situation starting with small, doing small things. And if you are not capable of doing small things, you can't do big ones. If you think of Ukraine, you think of Congo, you think of Sudan, you think of Uganda, you will never do anything. Because these situations are big for anybody, even for governments, even the United States. But if you concentrate on one at a time, you will do something. I tell people always, don't look at a situation so overwhelming that you cannot reach, you cannot touch. Don't look at this lake or this sea so big that you cannot put your feet in. Let your feet touch the water. Try, make an attempt. It's just like try to save one child in your life at a time. Try to say, this situation has affected so many women. Let me take one woman. If all of us in the world thought like that, we would be able to accomplish a lot. Say, this group, we are going to take the situation in Ukraine and we're going to save women and children, but not all. Let me start with this. Somebody else will join and do that. You know, it's all a matter of partnership. It's all a matter of attempting and trying to do something. But when we ignore and we neglect, we don't do anything, that situation will continue to the point that one time it will come very, very close to us, or it will come to our house, then we are not able to do anything ourselves.
One last question. I can imagine that many people are going to be so inspired after your visit to campus and hearing your talk this evening, and they're going to want to help support your mission. So how can listeners, especially students, become involved in your work and serve alongside of you?
Yeah, I would tell students, especially young people, that you are all very, very dynamic. And you look at the situation further than older people. At least with old people, you can become myopic. But young people, you have very broad vision and you can always plan new things. I invite all young people to get involved, especially in partnership, in moving out, in reading and finding out which situation needs support, which situation would need people who can volunteer. I mean, you must be able to put yourself to volunteer. You must be able to say, I am here. Don't hide in a corner. I tell young people, don't sit there and wait for a situation to find you. Move out and say, this situation, I would do something. I'm sure you have a kind of energy, you have a kind of intelligence, you have a kind of vision which can make you reach out and do something better. You are full of knowledge about technology, about this and that. Make that knowledge positive by changing the lives of people, by changing the situation. Be involved in transformative change in the world.
How can we be involved in that transformative change at St. Monica's or at the FTF?
That is interesting. You be involved in that by being able to take risk to come and see what the situation is. Because it is not enough to read and say, I've read about it. No, you need to come. Your presence is very, very vital. If you cannot come, you must find a way of going. Visually go or physically go. And I always tell people, some people go by giving and some people give by going. Where do you stand in that? It is all in your court. The ball is in your court.
That's beautiful. Well, that's a beautiful way to end it, too. And a great note. So with that concludes today's interview. If you are interested in learning more or hearing Sister Rosemary's full talk, which she'll be giving this evening at the Clark Forum, you can visit our website at clarkforum.org. Sister Rosemary, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, and I'm really happy to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you.